The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
If you're a fan of detective shows on TV, you're familiar with that aha moment, the point in the program where a clever investigator has an epiphany, suddenly piecing together a scattering of evidence, hunches, and clues that ultimately lead to solving a crime. Well, at UWM these days, there are classes being taught that help students learn how to analyze data in ways that really do solve crimes. It's all part of the field known as crime analysis. And here in the studio to talk to us about this wonderful effort is Stan Stojkovic, the dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare. Welcome back, Stan. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
So am I mischaracterizing this? I mean, there really are aha moments that occur in solving crimes.
Yeah, there are, but they're far and few between since most crimes are solved through confessions and not through an analysis necessarily of evidence or physical evidence or even analysis of crime trends. Most crimes are solved when people just simply confess to the criminal behavior. So there's less mystery in crime analysis than people think. But what we're trying to do is a little bit more analytical or on large data sets. And obviously we can explicate that as we continue through the show.
Yeah. So the whole idea of working with data is not at all new to crime prevention field. You have had lots of data in front of you for a long time.
Yes. And we know a lot about, you know, criminal behavior. We know about its incidents. We know where it occurs. We know when there are certain types of crime that occur, what kinds of crimes, when do they occur. The police know this as well. Criminal justice professionals, beginning with police, prosecutors, judges, corrections officials, they all have a pretty good sense. They have an informed intuition based on their experience. What we want to do is take that intuition of a lot of different people and look at crime in a much more systematic way and thereby delineating or discerning trends. And that's really what we're interested in.
So what's happening in the classroom? How is this different from what might have happened before?
Well, this is a little bit more hands-on. I mean, what we're talking about now is the analysis of large data, what we now know is the phenomenon of big data. And big data analysis is in healthcare, it's in the military, it's in the insurance business. It's the idea of taking big data and using advanced statistical techniques, maybe starting out a little bit simple, but then building on those techniques and then ultimately drawing some appropriate conclusions about where will crime occur, where has it occurred, what can we actually delineate? Can we break this down to individual blocks or precincts or districts where we can make appropriate allocation of police resources? Part of the incentive for this was that over the years, police budgets have shrunk. Other budgets in criminal justice have grown, like in corrections, but police budgets are largely funded by local communities, local municipalities, and as a result, they've been strained. And so police have been asked to be more efficient, be more efficient in how you allocate those scarce resources that we give you. And so this is a technique that can help departments make better decisions and justify those decisions in an empirical way.
So when you have these classes, this crime analysis program at the university, is it designed at that undergraduate student who perhaps has never stepped foot into a police station, has never worn a uniform, or are you aiming at that professional, someone who is already familiar with the field?
We're actually aiming for both. We'd like to prepare the future crime analysts, the people who are out there who would be employable careers in crime analysis, and we can talk about that at one level. But at another level, we would like people to come back, individuals who are in the criminal justice system, who have probably a pretty good sense, particularly the police, but it's not limited to the police, but they have a pretty good sense of about crime, about its distribution. They need the empirical basis to sort of, put a pat on the back to their intuition that says this is what we think is going on. The problem is that, most serious types of crime, or at least as portrayed by the media, or what we call the UCR index crimes, the big eight that the FBI defined back in the 1930s, homicide, robbery, sexual assault, aggravated assault, burglary, larceny, motor vehicle theft, those are the big ones, so to speak. As they get more serious, they're less common. And so they're much more problematic, let's say, in Milwaukee, in certain sections of Milwaukee, compared to a small town in rural Wisconsin. So Wisconsin has 629 police departments. Most of them have fewer than 10 police officers. Milwaukee PD is clearly very large, 2,000 police officers, the largest cities. So you'd see certain types of crimes occur more frequently. Now the question is, can we use analysts in an appropriate way where correct? And can we allocate those resources? This may not be necessarily efficacious for a department that's seen one homicide in 10 years. You know, what are we going to analyze? You know, other kinds of crimes might be more common. For example, shoplifting, which is the most common crime in America, that and drunk driving. Those types of things are in the thousands. And Wisconsin in particular has a huge issue with drunk driving. So this whole issue really is depending upon the community and what you want to really see. But I want to get that professional who's out there, but I also want to get that young man or woman who's interested in becoming an analyst. Analysts are not only at the local level. Right now, the federal level has a huge number of career options available for people who've developed the appropriate analytical techniques.
So if you go through your program, should one presume that someone who is studying to be a crime analyst might never strap a gun on and be out in the field, or does it cut both ways?
Well, I think that person has to understand what happens out in the field, and that may be best informed through some experience of being in the field. So it's a complement. So you complement this whole idea of experience with education. What I tell students is no one thing, experience or education, is going to get you where I think you want to go. In your life, in terms of a career, what you want is both increased experience and increased education constantly. Then your opportunities grow exponentially. So you really want both. And we want to capitalize on both. So this degree offering that we're putting together and that we have present right now is really geared toward both of those people starting out, but also those individuals who are in the field and really need the assistance. We feel that we can give them a lot of assistance.
You know, you've mentioned before how common it is to talk about big data, this enormous amount of information that is available as a result of tracking systems on our phones and cameras that are out there. And when you begin to imagine how do I find a job in this field, it can be a little intimidating to some folks who may not view themselves as, you know, particularly great at math good at building a geometric chart that shows the flow of data. Mm-hmm. So do you have to be a scientist in that sense, or are mm-hmm. there other skills that would allow you to still be successful in grappling with this huge amount of information?
Well, it's pretty, you know, it's an eclectic bunch when you look at it. Individuals who are former police officers who develop these analytical techniques, individuals who do have a propensity toward mathematics, science orientation. Clearly, that's not going to harm them or hurt them in this process. But for example, I had a student call me from Hofstra University last week, and she's interested. She's a forensic linguist. And so the idea of addressing and assessing language and how people use language. Now, this is enormously important in social media sites. So right now, law enforcement agencies are very interested in the analysis of data on social media, particularly for people who are doing things illegal, like, for example, a drug dealer or drug distribution network. It's you employing social media, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or whatever. They're using those things. Well, we need people to understand, how do we understand the language of that? And can we analyze that language? So being a forensic linguist is a pretty nascent developing area, but I can understand the relevance of that. And she was asking those questions, can I get a job as an analyst? And I said, well, let's talk about your background. And so the answer is yes, by the way, given the kinds of skills that she has and the analytical techniques. The techniques are fairly similar across disciplines. They're just applied in different contexts. And so in crime analysis, you're really looking at big data, the incidence of these events, and then analyzing those over time. And so there's a number of statistical techniques and graphic techniques, GPS kinds of techniques and mapping techniques that allow you to look at a big spreadsheet of the city, for example, and say, oh, okay, where's the distribution of offenses? Can we break it down even further? Can we disaggregate that data? How do we do that? What kind of modeling allows us to do that? Those are the kinds of techniques that we'll be developing in people.
So instead of having street addresses and statistics in terms of what crime and how much was stolen, just laid out on page after page after page, may be a lot tougher to understand than somehow transferring that into a graphic display.
A visual portrayal.
Visual portrayal.
Yeah, so you have this visual portrayal that says, oh, well, look, if I stand aback and I look at the city of Milwaukee and it's split up into 7 police districts, and I can say, oh, here's the distribution by offense. Here's when these offenses occur. here are the peak times. For example, we know that there's a lot of criminal activity around taverns and establishments where there's excessive drinking. There may be illegal drug dealing going on in those areas. We've known this for years. I've told students, listen, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. If you want to catch a drunk driver, sit out at 2 o'clock in the morning on Friday and Saturday night in front of, you know, your tavern of choosing, and you could probably arrest somebody for drunk driving. That's not difficult. But how do we make intelligent choices given the kinds of climate we're in? Some communities, they would view that as harassment, that you're harassing people if you're doing those types of – you have to balance these sort of political concerns, which are legitimate at the one level, with these sort of technical concerns. Because a crime analyst will say, well, here's where your problem is. Just go – you can be very linear and say, go deal with that problem. Put a lot of police officers in that district. Not that easy. It doesn't necessarily translate into that kind of process. But at least you have an empirically based understanding of, well, how much crime is it? Where does it occur? Who's doing it? Who are the victims? All of these things really started back in the 80s and 90s when the government was interested in moving from an aggregate system or a summary statistics system known as the Uniform Crime Reports, which are still around, to a national incident-based reporting system, NIBRS, in which people would report characteristics of the incident. Now, researchers, individuals who are interested in looking at trends, could now look at this and say, oh, instead of knowing that there were 50 sexual assaults last year in my community, I can know things about those sexual assaults. And then I can code those and look for trends and data. Now take that and extrapolate that to literally, you know, hundreds of thousands of cases or even millions of cases over time. That's big data. Can we use specific techniques that will allow us to discern trends that we would not otherwise see in smaller data sets, this type of stuff? And so it has direct application. I know in the city of Milwaukee, they're very much heavily invested. Chief Flynn's leadership has really been pretty excellent, I should say. I mean, he's been really committed to this kind of involvement and thinking about crime in a more analytical way and then applying those findings to specific resource allocation decisions. Now we have a basis for saying, why do we have all these police officers at this shift, at this location, at this time? That really helps us tremendously.
And in fact, I think Chief Flynn has been pointed out to be one of the leaders nationally in terms of using this data in a way that can effectively shape results, bring some real change here.
At the end of the day, it's about impact,
yeah,
and outcome.
So what about elsewhere? Are there Chief Flynns all over the country, or are there some law enforcement agencies who like to stick to the old way of doing things?
Well, you always have that problem. One of the things that analysts will tell you is you have to understand police culture. And oftentimes, police who are not trained in this are a little bit suspicious, and rightfully so. They don't know anything about it. But once we get people to become aware and to understand, and they don't need to be, you know, Einsteins here. They need to understand the conceptual model, and there's varying degrees of understanding how then that has value to me. So the federal government has recognized this for many, many years. It was really brought to the forefront when we looked at terroristic behavior, especially post 9/11, when there was a serious concern. Well, what information do we really have? What kind of information? How are we analyzing that information? Do we have people who are technically proficient and prepared to analyze data in that way to draw reasonable conclusions about what we should do in protecting the country? So that was the major impetus event, obviously. That was a major, major event that led us to say we need to develop this and build on this. And I think departments have seen that. At the federal level, there are literally thousands of positions open for crime analysts. And they can't fill them fast enough. Department of Homeland Security specifically is really looking for a lot of people with these analytical skills. So we at UWM said, you know, we have the people, and I've been hiring people with this expertise over the last 3 to 5 years. Let's utilize those people to really help local law enforcement, potentially prosecutor's office, corrections. This cuts across all areas of the criminal justice system to improve their efficiencies and to have a greater impact on this thing we call crime.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. I'm Tom Lujak. Joining us in the studio this week is Stan Stojkovich, the dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, talking about a new crime analysis program that has become part of the curriculum at the Helen Bader School. Stan, as we take a look at 2014 and the fact that you now have this system for teaching people how to use data, I can't help but think that with in this day of technology that some of what you're doing probably would not have been possible 10 or 15 years ago because you didn't have the computing power. You didn't have some of the other detective tools that are tied to technology that you have today.
That's correct. I mean, people say that, you know, the computing knowledge and the understanding of the hardware, the software, that's growing at an exponential rate, that we're developing new things every 6-7 years. Well, in the field of criminology and criminal justice, this idea of the application of large data analysis, it's a field ripe for that. You know, I mean, it really is, and particularly as you go to political leaders and say, listen, here's the evidence. This is what we have. But we also know that evidence doesn't sway everybody. You know, evidence about global warming hasn't swayed everyone to believe in global warming, but we have good evidence dealing with that topic. The same is true here. We have good evidence that we can draw some conclusions. Where there's a mistake in the application of aggregate data is when individuals try to use an understanding of crime in the United States, okay, as sort of a massive construct. That has limitations tremendously because that doesn't help anybody in Peoria. Peoria has to analyze its own data, as does Milwaukee and Madison. And while there may be similarities, and what I would expect there would be these similarities, there are also incredible differences. And then the appropriate strategies to respond cannot be uniform. They have to be pretty varied because those communities are varied and they have differential levels of expectations of their police on what's the best way to interact. So data by itself is nothing actually until you put it in the context in which that data is actually applied reasonably and correctly.
Well, and it sounds like not only isn't data enough, but just a software package may not be enough either. You need that human touch to go ahead and provide that point of differentiation between one community's crime statistics and another's.
Yes, and then, you know, look at Milwaukee County, for example. You got 19 municipalities. And when you start to look at them, they are varied. They're different. And they'll tell you we're here because we don't want to be there, you know, on all sorts of dimensions, crime, healthcare, road repair, education, you name it, they vary. And, you know, that's one of the powers of democracy in a truly democratic state. That kind of variability is nice at one level. At another level, it can be terribly inefficient. And so arguments about consolidation, about, you know, moving police departments, for example, in the late 80s, early 90s, they shrunk. We had close to 17,000 police agencies in this country, you know, municipal, state, county, federal. That shrunk to a little over 16,000 in about a 10-year period, largely due to costs. So, and we had seen that here in Wisconsin where some departments said, listen, we're going to go with the sheriff's department to provide law enforcement services and cut those administrative costs associated with our small local PD that has 5 or 6 police officers. Well, you can't blame the citizens and the taxpayers of that community who are asking those kinds of questions. But there's also a trade-off. And the trade-off is, do we have that kind of responsive local control at one level? And there's a number of other issues, obviously. But cost can't drive everything, but it is a primary consideration in the public sector now where you face constantly infinite expectations, but you only have finite resources.
So where does the U.S. stand in comparison to the rest of the world when it comes to using these new techniques to crunch the data and, at the end of the day, catch the bad guys and gals and get them off the street?
Well, my sense is that the United States is probably in the middle of the pack on this kind of stuff, largely because in a democratic society, the use of information is really watched. We see in the WikiLeaks, we see in the Mr. Snowden case, you know, his position being that the government was doing all these things that were not right, or at least in some cases, in some opinions, illegal. That's debatable. That's debatable whether or not he did us a service or he was a traitor, and people can weigh in on those kinds of things. But the fact is, in countries where they don't have those kinds of concerns or considerations, they're doing these things already. They're collecting extensive DNA databases. They're monitoring people. They don't have HIPAA. They don't have laws that protect you against certain types of things. That doesn't necessarily make them safer, however. So that's sort of a false expectation or a false illusion when individuals say, well, we need to do this because then we catch all the bad guys. Well, it doesn't turn out to be that way. And in fact, what we know like about crime in particular, the most common crimes in America, they explain anywhere from 40 to 60% of all crime are two offenses, drunk driving and shoplifting in terms of distribution. All right. And drunk driving is a huge issue. So is shoplifting. A third of all businesses go under the first 18 months because of shoplifting and or employee theft. So there's a lot of issues in terms of how do you understand the application of crime? When can I use crime? And I always tell students, you come to university because you don't know anything about crime except what you see on television. And most of that is just flat wrong. You're not going to drive a Maserati. You're not going to have a high-paying job and fly around the country and use techniques, but by the way, that scientifically don't exist yet. So get that out of your head. Let's be real about this, and this is one thing that is very real.
Got to talk to you a bit more about technology because there are two pieces of technology that have become very controversial because of the desire by some law enforcement agencies to either begin using it or to greatly increase their use. One is the use of drones, and the other is the ubiquitous presence of cameras on streets. Mm-hmm. Let's take that last one first. Been reading a lot lately about some countries like England, for example, where they appear to be. I've not been there for a few years, so I haven't seen it for myself. But a friend who just came back said he felt like he was being followed. Cameras right around every corner. Do you think we're headed in that same direction here
in
America?
We are to some degree. I mean, and in fact, when you start if you couch the argument, you know, freedom versus security, it's a false argument. It's a false dichotomy. And many people look at it that way and they say, well, listen, if you want to be secure, you got to give up some of your freedom. That's not necessarily the case, all right? The question is the efficacy of these things. Do they actually make sense? And what do we glean from them, okay? What's actually learned from them? CATV, for example, in England has been around for many, many years. And there's been a lot of research evaluating, well, what impact does it actually have? What kind of crime are you talking about? Because crime is a ubiquitous term, okay? Especially what we know about the distribution of crime, all right? And what do you really want to be able to provide? And so the technology can never be the first order. Technology is a tool. First, you have to define your purpose. Technology can never tell you what your purpose should be. You should first say, this is what I want to achieve, and this is the technology. So people have, in some cases, inverted that argument. Well, we have this technology, therefore our purpose is. For example, in law enforcement now, the availability of license plate readers, you know, things that are in cars where they just read every license plate that goes by, store it in the database, run a warrant check, and find out. I mean, I've had police chiefs tell me in small communities, I know everybody is in my community at every point in time. And when that first came out, I said, did you ever get a call from the ACLU? Did you ever get a call from people who feel like they're being watched? And what authority do you have to do these kinds of things? And oftentimes, if the technology is driving that question, we don't ask those questions. Well, we should ask those questions up front before we think about the application of an appropriate technology.
So how about drones? Where do we stand on that? It's aerial drones in particular, the ones that, you know, could be the size of a bumblebee buzzing, you know, 50 or 500 feet above us, and we would never know it.
Well, that's the power when you, Plato said 2,000 years ago roughly that when you have a secret entity doing things and you don't have control over that entity, you will become a slave to that entity. And, you know, that's a little bit dramatic, but the fact of the matter is you do have to watch. And in a democracy, it matters. In a totalitarian state where there is no pretense of freedom, it doesn't matter. But in this country, it should matter. And again, we should be asking ourselves about application. When people say, you know, well, what's the problem? You know, the problem is who gets access to it. The problem is misuse. This is the issue with healthcare data, right? Who gets access to the data? Who knows what? Is that going to be used to my disadvantage? Or, which we have a history of, the disadvantage of large groups of people who tend not to look like the dominant majority. And when that stuff starts to happen, then you start to see you're actually reverting into a totalitarian state. So these kinds of issues, I think, are very, very serious. They need to be addressed, but they need to be addressed in the political climate that's rational and reasonable. Remember, the Patriot Act was passed 6 to 8 weeks after 9/11 with no discussion and virtually no discussion and no debate, and it had long-term implications on a number of things that affect our freedom in this country.
And you know, as we're talking about the crime analysis program at UWM, the fact that you're teaching young and sometimes not so young people to go ahead and use data, process it, and make it of value to the crime fighting field, one could easily see how a person could look at the use of drones or look at multiplying 2 or 3 or 4 times the number of surveillance cameras out there and think, automatically, well, that must be a good thing because it's more data. You know, we're providing more information. So won't that make that student who someday is going to be working for the government as a crime analyst better equipped?
More data to do what? You know, more data that may be misdirected. So the question is, what do you want to really have an impact on? I've said this for years. Put the analytical techniques, because they're just refined techniques, aside. We know a lot about the distribution of drunk driving. We know a lot about the addictive behaviors associated with alcohol. We know a lot about when these things occur, right? But we do very little to actually enforce that, all right? And when we try to enforce laws that really go after people aggressively, all right, we get pushback from a number of different interested parties. Well, that's the nature of the political process. So the real question is, do you really want – be careful what you want for, the old Chinese proverb, right? Be careful what you wish for. And what is it that you're really directing your efforts toward? Do you believe that cameras and drones are going to stop homicides? No. If you know, understand the nature and the distribution of homicide, you could have a camera on every corner or a cop on every corner, and that's not going to address that issue. So people's thoughts about this are misdirected. They have a misperception about the role of technology and the power of technology. What can it actually do? When people say to me about, for example, sexual assault, which is a very serious violent crime, 1 in 5 women in this country before they die will be sexually assaulted. Well, who are they assaulted by? They tend to be assaulted by their boyfriends, their husbands, acquaintances, friends, uncles.
Family members, yeah.
Exactly. A vast majority. And children, the same thing. Children who are victims of sexual violence. But nobody wants to address that issue. But they want to build. They want to misdirect. They want to build a facility or a place to lock these guys away. Well, those guys don't pose the real aggregate serious threat to you. This other group does, but it's too difficult to look at that group. Because that group means what? We're looking at ourselves much more so. And that forms some real serious introspection about, oh, my God, what are we really talking about here? Okay? And once you have that information, you're going to have to answer those questions, because the information by itself is meaningless unless you really have appropriate application.
And as you point out, not only might that additional information not help you prevent the crime you'd like to prevent, but it could lead to mischief. It could lead to people who collect that information to use it in ways as that was never intended.
The classic example of that is sex offender registries. Enormous vigilantism, enormous pushing people underground, hiding under, you know, expressways, not ordinances passed, right? And I've dealt with this issue about 10 years ago. The intended consequence that you think is going to occur will not occur. It'll be the exact opposite. And ironically, you actually make yourself less safe by doing these things, if you look at the research literature on this. So that's why being careful. Crime analysis is about being analytical within specific techniques, but then the application of that information. What is the purpose we're trying to achieve? Don't ever lose sight of that first order question. That's the most important thing that we have to – first, the technology then comes second.
Just a minute left, Stan. For people who might be interested in this field, what do they need to do to connect to the Bader School and this crime analysis program?
All they have to do is go to two sites. One is our webpage, obviously www.4.udwm.edu/HBBSSW, which is Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, or go to our Facebook page, same address, UWMHBSSW. And you'll see our Facebook page, and we have all sorts of things out there that can give you more information. You can obviously contact my office as well if you have some questions, and I'll put you on to the right people, and we'll go
from
there.
And you could fulfill your CSI fantasy.
Well, you know, I want to change that fantasy to a much more realistic portrayal about what people can actually do.
Gotcha. Stan Stojkovich, thanks so much. Appreciate
Thank you.
Having you on. Stan Stojkovich, Dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You have been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.